Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 13 years, it was a largely private family tragedy. In 1990, Terry Schiavo, a 26-year-old woman with her whole life ahead of her, suffered a heart attack. She was left severely brain damaged and has been in a coma-like vegetative state ever since. Now, it seems everyone knows her story. A bitter legal battle between her husband, Michael, and her parents over removing Terry's feeding tube and allowing her to die has sparked national debate and unprecedented intervention by the Florida legislature and Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Tonight on Point, Terry Schiavo, the right to die. And who gets to decide? We begin with the latest developments in the case. Joining me from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Deborah Sharp, who's covering the story for USA Today. Good evening, Deborah Sharp. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good evening.
Deborah, what's the latest? Can you tell us exactly how the legislature and the governor intervened at the last minute?
Well, it really was a last-minute effort. Apparently, they had been flooded with concerned emails and letters and, voices from the voters, to which they responded. And there was kind of a hastily called vote, and it ended with the legislature handing the governor the power to reconnect the feeding tube that the courts in Florida had ordered removed.
So on October 15th, that's last week, the Sixth Circuit Court there had ordered that it come out, that Terry Schiavo be allowed to die. Does anyone know how near death she was when this was turned around? Will she recover from the dehydration and, I guess, starvation that was underway?
The main problem is really the dehydration. That is ultimately the first thing that the body responds to by shutting down the kidneys. And doctors did say that, not her doctors, understand her particular medical condition is a private matter, but doctors unrelated to the case say that, even over the 6 days that she was not connected to the feeding tube, that lack of hydration could take a toll on her kidneys and then ultimately other body organs.
So at this point, what's known about her medical condition? We heard that she's being rehydrated before nutrients are being provided, but just getting water back in her system.
Yes, that is a first step, and actually we don't know that officially because, as I mentioned before, medical condition is private in Florida, and the hospital won't actually even confirm that she's there, despite the fact that most of America has seen her arriving via ambulance, as recorded by TV cameras.
Deborah Sharp, what's the political context for this turnabout on Terry Schiavo? Was this driven largely by emotion? There was moving video footage of her sitting up and her eyes open. She doesn't look like the stereotypical comatose person. Or was it something about politics in Florida that moved the governor and legislature?
Well, I do think, emotion equals politics, and in this case it's particularly true, and I do think that the impact of that video had quite a large effect on how this case ultimately was resolved.
What did it show exactly, Deborah?
What, the video?
Yes.
It did show her sitting up with her eyes open. Many medical experts would say that that is an indication of, reflexive movements, that people who are in persistent vegetative states are able, in fact, to, track objects, to make sounds, to, have their eyes follow objects.
Mm-hmm. But that's not the way her parents interpreted it.
No, they certainly don't. And many of the supporters go along with that view, that, in fact, she is more conscious than many medical experts have given her credit for, and that's what the family believes.
And the conflict between her parents, Robert and Mary Schindler, and her husband, Michael Schiavo, what are the elements of that? It's been going on for a long time now.
It has been. It's a 6-year legal battle, and although it's, most recently come to the nation's attention, I mean, this is something that has rent apart this family.
What are they fighting over? He's still married to Terry Schiavo, but he's got a girlfriend, a child by that, or a woman he's engaged to, a child, another child on the way, and is there money at stake here as well?
Well, it's a little hard to get that because, as with so much else in this case, both sides bitterly disagree on what the motives are. Michael Schiavo believes that he's doing exactly what his wife would have wanted him to do. The parents believe that he is motivated by financial gain or whatever, and that's why he's doing what he's doing.
And the political gain here, does anyone stand to benefit politically one way or another?
Well, that's a hard call because, like, you know, so much of politics, one way the wind is blowing one day can blow completely different the next day. But I do believe that the governor and the Republican-controlled legislature certainly responded to a huge outpouring of emotion here, and whether or not that's reflected in how people end up voting remains to be seen.
Deborah Sharp, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Deborah Sharp is covering the Terri Schiavo story for USA Today. She spoke with me from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Earlier today, I spoke with Democratic State Senator Steve Geller, who voted against legislation giving Governor Jeb Bush authority to order Terri Schiavo back on a feeding tube. I asked the Florida legislator who he thinks should ultimately decide her fate.
First of all, I believe that the next of kin, which is in this case the husband, should be making the decisions. I believe that the courts should be making the decision. I do not believe that the legislature and the governor should be making these decisions.
Because they're intervening in a purely family matter?
It's funny. The legislature and the governor have prided themselves on being so pro-family. I saw yesterday a press release from the Speaker of the House where he was touting himself as having a 100% voting record from the Christian Coalition on the preservation of the institution of marriage. How do you try and preserve the institution of marriage and take away from the next of kin, the surviving spouse, the ability to make life and death decisions on, in this case, the wife? That's inappropriate. Understand, the courts study this issue extensively. They heard lengthy testimony from doctors. They heard testimony from a lot of people, not just the husband, that said that these were Terri's wishes. They heard from the parents. They heard from the doctors hired by the parents. And they found by a standard of clear and convincing evidence that she would not wish to live in that state. They found that, and I'll read from the court opinion, much of her cerebral cortex is simply gone and has been replaced by cerebrospinal fluid. Teresa will always remain in an unconscious, reflexive state. The only debate between the doctors is whether she has a small amount of isolated living tissue in her cerebral cortex or whether she has no living tissue in her cerebral cortex. The courts are the triers of fact. They heard hours and days and weeks of testimony. The legislature heard no testimony, didn't hear from one doctor, and in this state that prides itself on the strength of the family, decided to overrule the next of kin.
So what's your sense, Senator Geller, of the moving impulse, at least in the Florida Senate? The Senate President, James King from Jacksonville, said, I really do hope we've done the right thing. He said, may God have mercy on all of us. Clearly not an easy decision. What do you think drove this 23-15 vote in the Florida Senate?
I believe that a lot of this involved politics, and there's two separate issues. Number one, the Speaker of the House is involved in a Republican primary for U.S. Senate, and there seems to be a race in the Republican primary to see who can show that they are the most conservative candidate. A lot of people felt that in their particular districts, that they would come under attack and maybe in a Republican primary if they did not vote, quote-unquote, the right way, because the Operation Rescue and the Christian Coalition have made this a major issue. I will tell you that I've had enough Republican senators come up to me and tell me that they knew that they were voting the wrong way, but politically they felt they had to vote that way. What many of my colleagues in the Senate told me is that the only reason that they were able to vote for this is that they were confident that the Supreme Court would eventually strike down this law. I've been in the legislature for 16 years. I do not recall any other case where the legislature has passed a bill that the bill was created and passed on the same day and that affects only one individual. I just don't ever recall seeing that before in 16 years.
Senator Geller, even after all of the court's consideration, did it give you no pause that Terri Schiavo's parents were begging so desperately for her life to be sustained?
I understand the love of a parent for a child. I have two little boys. I can understand that the Schiavos cannot let their daughter go. I understand that on issues which the court has ruled are merely reflexes, that the Schiavos read a lot more into that because they're feeling that they're trying to save the life of their little girl. I understand. I sympathize with that. But they've also tried to make the husband out to be the brute, and the Court of Appeals specifically said in one of their rulings that the husband was a, you know, I'll just read you quickly, Teresa has been blessed with loving parents and a loving husband. Michael has continued to care for her. He has become a professional respiratory therapist, works in a nearby hospital. As a guardian, he has always attempted to provide optimum treatment for his wife. He has been a diligent watchguard of Teresa's care. This is not what you're reading about. This is not what you're hearing about. But that is the ruling of the Second District Court of Appeals.
Senator Geller, thank you for joining us.
You're certainly welcome.
Democratic Senator Steve Geller represents Florida's 31st District in Hallandale. He spoke with me from Tallahassee, Florida. He voted against the legislation that put the feeding tube back to Terry Schiavo. Joining me now from Tallahassee is Republican State Representative Sandra Merman, who co-sponsored the new law. Good evening and welcome, Representative Merman.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Thanks so much for being with us. You've had a lot to wrestle with down there in the last few days.
Absolutely.
How did you come to the decision after all of the consideration that had been given this case? It had been, I guess, Michael Schiavo wanted, he was insisting on his wife's right to die. He came victorious out of Florida's state courts, its Supreme Court, and the federal courts, and in a sense, in the U.S. Supreme Court, which refused to hear the case. So how did you decide it was important for the legislature to jump in here and dictate a different outcome?
Well, the way I saw it, and of course, we have a lot of lawyers in the legislature that tried to turn this into a real legal argument. But the way I saw it is that the courts were their power was totally imbalanced on this. They had not looked at a lot of issues in this case. They hadn't looked at the abuse of a disabled person. There were definitely
what was the abuse? What was the abuse? May I just ask?
Well, there were allegations of abuse of Michael Schiavo on his wife Teresa
She was disabled, while she was in this coma-like state.
No, before she became disabled and came into the state. And then there were also allegations of abuse of her after she got in the state while he was hopefully waiting for her to die.
And the other elements you don't think they considered?
They looked at, but they didn't really consider it as part of the argument. And the judge kept turning it down, and the way I felt about it, and several of my colleagues in the House, is that there was the courts kept turning this down. The Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, would not hear the case, and you know, we're faced with people in our courtrooms, these judges who have become judicial activists. Actually, they are trying to make policy and not just interpret the law.
Representative Merman, do you believe that there are circumstances in which an American should have a right to die?
If they have, if they execute an agreement that they do not want to be resuscitated, if that's their wishes, absolutely.
And what about the argument about the next of kin? If this is opened up to an extended family's input, isn't it likely that there'll always be someone in the extended family who raises an objection? Might that make it impossible for people being kept alive by artificial means to exercise that right to die?
Well, I think that was part of the argument, was that the courts, there was so much disagreement between the parents, and really what needed to happen in this case is the courts needed to appoint a guardian ad litem for Teresa Schiavo, who could be independent, who would represent her, so that the judge would feel, he kept seeing these two parties opposing each other, and, of course, never came up with a solution of how to deal with this situation. I think a guardian ad litem, of course, we made that provision in the bill, would definitely done a lot more before this point in time. I thought the real issue to me and my colleagues was this was a very inhumane way to have a person die, to starve to death.
And so the court's order is overturned. The legislature is there. Sandra Merman, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sandra Merman, Representative Sandra Merman joined us from Tallahassee. She's a Tampa Republican. She co-sponsored the new law that authorized Governor Jeb Bush to order the feeding tube restored to Terri Schiavo. What do you make of the fate of Terri Schiavo? If there's no living will, who should decide? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Florida's Terri Schiavo, the right to die, and who should decide. You can join the conversation. If there is no living will, who should decide? And were the courts right to say, let her die? Was the legislature right to intervene? And if you face this in your family, have you talked through the what-ifs of being kept alive artificially, maybe for many years? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Augustine, Florida, William Allen. He's director of the Bioethics Law and Medical Professionalism Program at the University of Florida. Good evening and welcome, William Allen.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. And also with us from Steubenville, Ohio, is Rita Marker. She's executive director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Good evening and welcome, Rita Marker.
Hello.
William Allen, to you first. Lots of issues raised by what's happened in Florida in the last week, but take us through that from an ethicist's point of view. What is at stake in this debate over the fate of Terri Schiavo?
Well, what's at stake is Florida's constitutional right to die, I shouldn't call it right to die. Some people confuse that with assisted suicide. Right to refuse medical treatment, including life-sustaining treatment, and artificial means of being kept alive when you're in a condition that you wouldn't want to be.
So she was on the path toward dying. The feeding tube was out. She was being dehydrated and, I guess, at some level starved as well. And the idea was that she would die. That's what her husband wanted. The legislature has intervened. I'm reading here.
The legislation set this up to do this exactly this way. It says the spouse of the person, if they haven't designated anybody, is the person most likely to know what they would have wanted. And if that person can convince the court that they know what they would have wanted, that's exactly the way this was set up by the legislature in the early 90s.
Oh, but by which legislature? Florida's?
Florida legislature, sure. This has been clear. There's nothing new about this case legally and substantively that hadn't been settled for over a decade in terms of Florida law. It's just the dispute and the national attention that has brought this about.
But aren't they reversing the earlier legislation before they said next of kin? They've intervened.
They've never they didn't say next of kin. They gave an order, but yeah, they have intervened now, but they've intervened in a strange way. It gives the governor a 15 days to do a stay, and governor after that doesn't have any authority. So it's obviously designed just for this case, although I don't know what will happen if this happens with somebody else.
Well, the precedent here seems to be getting attention. I'm reading Arthur Kaplan at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He says this is beyond extraordinary. It borders on flat-out irresponsible. He says there's a Pandora's box opened here when you let more family members get involved than just the next of kin. He says if you spread out this authority to a wider circle, you're going to get logjam after logjam after logjam, and ultimately no one will be able to exercise that right to die.
I agree with Art on that. Imagine this, that you had told your spouse exactly what you wanted under these circumstances. You hadn't written it down, and most people haven't written it down, but a lot of people have told their spouse or some other relative, even their physician, what they wanted without writing it down. Then something happens to you, or an accident or something else, and all of a sudden some family member who has different religious views than you or who doesn't know you said that or has whatever motivations can come along, as well-meaning as they may be, and thwart your wishes. And it puts holds people hostage to some other family member or group of family members when they have told, you know, the person closest to them what they wanted.
So it's a big move in the face of that precedent. Rita Marker, how do you see it? Is there a tide being turned here in Florida over the Terri Schiavo case?
Well, actually, I see it very, very different than Professor Allen does. first of all, the statement that a person can't exercise their rights, certainly they can, and those provisions are in the Florida law and have been.
Well, they can if they're conscious and able to,
yes,
to
that's
act.
True. And
but the whole idea is, in this case, they're not.
Right. But prior to that, they could have exercised that right by having a living will or, as we urge people to do, whether they are 18 or 81, to designate someone to make medical decisions for them if they cannot. Now, in this particular case, you have a court-appointed guardian who happens to be her husband. Interestingly enough, though, he didn't remember that she didn't want this sort of intervention until after the $1.3 million settlement check was in the bank. It was not from the very beginning. In fact, it was after the money was received. And this is also a situation of not a lot of interlopers deciding, but in fact, if someone had no clear and convincing evidence that they would want to essentially die of dehydration, and in addition to that, if a family member said, no, this is not what they wanted, then in that case, then there can be a stay on the whole thing. And so what this does is actually expand what is meant by the Florida law, because Florida law does make it very clear that you can designate someone, that you can say, I don't want this, and you can do this by clear and convincing evidence.
So you now, do see this, this expansion.
Florida law has clearly said that if someone doesn't do that, then the next of kin could decide in this order, presuming they're the ones who know what the patient would want.
Well,
it said that for over a decade, and this has been done a lot of times before that. Now, there's nothing new about this.
But I think if you're looking at specific,
someone has to have written it means only 30% of the people in the United in Florida could have treatment withdrawn on this basis.
William Allen, let me ask you: do you
in every case the next of kin knows if somebody has more credible evidence, the court could decide that. In this case, the courts looked at this; they believed the husband's evidence. They never ever believed the wife's. The parents had any evidence to controvert it. But this should be made on a case-by-case basis in the courts. I have recommended in ethics consultation cases like this that the current spouse who would be first in line might have a conflict of interest, and it should go to a court and have a guardian. There are cases where that's true, but that doesn't mean every case is true or it's automatic or that we ought not to honor people's choices if they've told someone and have never written it down.
William Allen, is there a conflict of interest in this case? Is there $1 million sitting in a bank waiting for Terry Schiavo to die before it flows to her husband?
The problem is, first of all, there's no $1 million in the bank. He spent most of this money in the legal battles and in taking care of her over these years.
Oh,
so
no,
it's not like that money's sitting around in the bank and he's going to profit from all of it. The second thing is, although you have to look at potential secondary gains and things like that, if just because somebody happens to be going to inherit money, and usually the surviving spouse is the one who inherits it, doesn't mean that that person didn't tell them what they wanted and that they're not right about it.
Rita Marker, isn't it?
We're not in a position to judge that unless we have evidence that he's got the wrong motives.
Rita Marker, let me put it to you. Isn't it possible, even likely, that a spouse would be more contemporary, more up-to-date in their understanding of what a person might want in the event of this kind of profound disability than parents?
Certainly it is possible, but here we're talking about possible. This is a case, you know, it's interesting and ironic that if you have a situation where someone has not written a will for their property, you can't just have someone in the family who stands to inherit their property say, they told me that they wanted me to have all of this. That wouldn't fly. And yet when it has to do with their life, this is what we're saying. The idea of this opening a Pandora's box, it does not open a Pandora's box.
Well, you called it an expansion yourself.
I called it a clarification and expansion of the law. It in no way contradicts the law. And what it does is that it says very clearly, if the person did not have clear evidence, if they didn't have an advance directive. And what we're asking here and what Mr. Allen is saying is that we should say, well, if the husband said this, but when you look at the possible conflicts of interest here, and he mentioned that the money had been spent on her care and on the legal suits, Terry Schiavo has not even had her teeth cleaned for 10 years. He has refused to permit that. She has not had a gynecological exam in over a decade. So even her basic care has not been provided for, even though the money was there to do it, but it was not.
Are you opposed on the face of it to this so-called right to die? Is your group opposed to that, Rita Marker?
We certainly are in favor of everyone being able to say what they do and they do not want. We do not favor the idea of dehydrating a disabled woman to death on the word of her husband, remembered after he got a check in the bank and after he had been living with another woman and had a child by her. He doesn't quite come across as the loving, concerned husband.
And yet a lot of courts have looked at this and decided otherwise. You're assuming he's doing it out of avarice. What if he's doing it out of love? William Allen, Rita Marker, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. What do you think in the absence of a living will? Should a spouse have the ultimate say? And what about the parents? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ian's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Loud and clear.
Okay. I just wanted to say that my feeling on the matter is that this poor woman has she's married this man, and she has made a conscious choice by marrying him to put her faith in him, whereas your parents are the people that you were born to. That's important, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily the people that you trust most in the world.
So you'd leave next of kin to the husband and have him be the one who decides?
Unless they're separated or estranged, absolutely. She's chosen, you know, to marry this person and put her trust in him to take care of her in sickness and in health. And if she's been able to show that sort of faith and trust in him, then I think the courts and the doctors and so on should follow suit.
Ian, thanks for your call. William Allen, is that essentially what the position had been in Florida until this case and this legislation?
Well, yes, and after the 15 days is up, it will be again unless the legislature does something else. They've only given the authority to the governor for a stay for 15 days.
That's inaccurate.
I've read the legislation.
But you didn't read it carefully, because the legislation specifically says he has 15 days to issue the stay. It does not say that the stay expires in 15 days.
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't say that he has the authority to issue a stay in anybody else's case after that 15 days.
But William Allen, a permanent stay in the case of Terry Schiavo?
Well, it could be. What he's done in addition to the stay is put it in the hands of the chief circuit judge to appoint a guardian ad litem to make the decision, essentially, or to decide what is in Terry Schiavo's best interest.
I would tell you, as an attorney,
but the governor's authority to, in other words, this doesn't change the law for everybody else in Florida. Now, the legislature may go ahead and try to decide to do that, but this one doesn't. It only is going to apply. Well, you know what? It applies to anybody else who becomes in her situation in the next 15 days.
No, it applies to anybody else in the situation that I described of someone who does not have an advance directive and someone for whom food and fluids are going to be withheld and someone for where the family disagrees.
But just in the next 15 days?
No. The governor had 15 days to issue the stay. And he has now issued the stay on any cases like this. The stay does not expire in 15 days, but he had 15 days to issue it. He issued it yesterday. He could have issued it up to 15 days. Once issued, it is there. But if we can go on to something else, because the gentleman that called in talked about the fact that she had chosen that he would care for her in sickness and in health.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't really care for her after she became disabled. And as far as her...
you're asserting that repeatedly, but the courts have looked at this in some depth, I guess, over a number of years and decided otherwise.
And they would not allow that. That's not the case.
If you look in the court record, and we have filed briefs in this, we have been very much involved in this case, the court record, the facts as they are in the record, they are very clear that she has not been receiving the basic sorts of care, such as dental hygiene and the general sorts of physical care that one would receive, because he has refused to okay those. He has refused to okay the most basic type of rehabilitation, the most basic type of stimulation. He has ordered that she not get any type of rehab. He has ordered that there not be any physical therapy for her.
But didn't the court come down saying that this woman is beyond rehabilitation? This
exactly.
woman is beyond.
They said on the basis of expert physicians who say she can't be rehabilitated.
That she could be rehabilitated. and there were others that said that she could.
Well, now, there's always conflicting testimony, but
very telling things.
There's always conflicting testimony, but the court decided the other way here. James is calling from Clinton, Massachusetts. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a thought about this as I was thinking about it. I'm not well versed in the issue, but the thing that occurs to me is that we have a lot of pressures on our medical system now, and this is certainly not going to become less of an issue as time goes by and these pressures increase. And it just occurs to me, I would like for your guests to just consider for a second the idea of legislation that would actually turn this on its head and say that if you are found to be in a condition, you know, enumerated as brain dead or so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that the law would require that you would be, you know, you not have life support unless you had a living will that specifically said, I want to have life support that keeps me alive when I'm brain dead.
So turn it all around and make the presumption go the other way. William Allen, does that align up with the Hippocratic Oath or with general medical practice? Isn't there a kind of fundamental directive?
Well, the Hippocratic Oath doesn't address this directly. It says first do no harm, and this depends on your definition of harm. The other woman, I can't remember her name, believes this is harmful. The Florida law allows people to decide that for themselves, and so to do what he is suggesting. First of all, brain death is being used too loosely here. Whole brain death means that the brain stem is dead. She is not
mm-hmm.
brain dead by whole brain death criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he means higher cortex death, which some people would like to be the definition of brain death, then that might work. But I don't think you could get social consensus on that. This is a state where a lot of people would find it burdensome to be kept alive and would not want to be kept alive, and so we allow them to make the decision not to. But we haven't, as a society, I don't think, come to the consensus that that this is a way to allocate resources, and I think you'd have difficulty getting that consensus, although a lot of people would feel that way. Mm.
Rita Marker, what's your view on this? Technology keeps advancing. Many people do fear being kept alive in some near-dead state for a long time. What about flipping the presumption?
I'd like to really answer that and to say a couple of other things without Mr. Allen interrupting.
Well, I'd ask that of all of our guests, including you, Rita, please. But please go ahead.
That's very good. I'm glad you did that. Now, first of all, she is not brain dead. That is correct. Secondly, she is not near brain dead. That's by, like, being a little bit pregnant. I think one of the most telling things in this is, however, that Judge Greer was asked by the family when he said that he was going to set a date for the removal of the tube. And the family said, okay, set the date, and if you set it 2 months from now or 3 months from now or 3 weeks from now, during that time, because there are medical experts that have testified that she does have the ability to relearn how to swallow, at least permit her to begin to receive therapy to swallow so she could eat by mouth. If, in fact, she cannot do that by the time that date arrives for the feeding tube, okay. But permit that rehabilitation and an attempt for her ability to swallow food by mouth. That was denied. So even the chance that she could continue to take food by mouth was denied to her. Now, while the law says and specifically states that food and fluids received by tube feeding are considered medical treatment, food by mouth is not.
Rita Marcus, stand by. We've got to take a short break. I want to get a last word from William Allen before we do. William Allen, do you see a fundamental change in this decision or not?
It depends on the interpretation of it. I do see the threat of a fundamental change. If people are held hostage to a family member who disagrees, then we're going to have major problems, and I believe Art is right. It's just unworkable to do that.
William Allen, I know we've got to let you go. Thanks for joining us tonight. Thanks very much for being with us. William Allen is director of the Bioethics, Law, and Medical Professionalism Program at the University of Florida. Rita Marker, stand by. We're talking tonight about Florida's Terry Schiavo, the right to die and who should decide. How do you interpret Jeb Bush's intervention here, a lifesaver or political grandstanding? How would you have cast your vote? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Florida's Terry Schiavo, about the right to die and who should decide. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the fate of Terry Schiavo? If there's no living will, who should decide? And do you believe in the right to die. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Steubenville, Ohio, by Rita Marker, Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. We're joined now by Arthur Kaplan, Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, Arthur Kaplan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. How do you read the significance of what Florida's done in the last 24 hours in the case of Terry Schiavo?
Well, I'd have to say I think it's unethical, unconstitutional, and unconscionable. Other than that, pretty good decision.
Explain each of those three, please.
Historically, when people have had to make decisions about stopping treatment, the ethical principle that we've always followed is let the husband or wife decide. Let them try and articulate the values, the views that the person who can't communicate would want. When the Florida legislature stepped in and said, nope, we know better, we're going to allow others to step in and veto that traditional right that husbands and wives had, they've really stepped right off a cliff in terms of ethics.
So that makes it look unethical in your eyes. Unconstitutional? Absolutely. How so?
The husband, Mr. Schiavo, he has been attacked by Terry's mom and dad and brother and sister as not being an appropriate guardian, as someone who should not be making these decisions. They've hinted that he's trying to get insurance money, that he's having an affair and other things. 19 judges in the state of Florida in 6 different trials over 6 years have looked at those claims and dismissed them. Again, when the governor steps in and says, we know better than our court system who should be the guardian, the man has never been dismissed as the guardian by every court in the state of Florida. I think he'll appeal it, and I think the Florida courts or the Supreme Court will say you can't arbitrarily throw someone aside as a guardian. Unconstitutional.
So what's your reading of why this has happened? And we heard earlier from a representative from Tampa, who said, look, we just couldn't let this happen. It just didn't look right to us.
Yeah, I understand their sympathy in terms of saying here's a woman who's facing certain death with the removal of medical technology that lets her get food and fluids, and the parents want to do something, and if the husband doesn't, then why not let the parents go? But the issue is not what the parents want, what the sister wants. It isn't even really what the husband wants. It's what Terry Schiavo would have wanted. The husband says she would not want to lie in a bed for 13 years unable to think, feel, communicate, or sense. That is a fate that he refuses to let her endure. For the legislature to step in and say, well, we respect the idea that we'll continue that, I think is just misguided emotionalism at best. And I think they're doing a little political posturing on this one.
Why?
Because I think they people in the state believe that if they hear about this sort of abstractly, here's a young woman who, somehow or another, her husband is cruelly letting her die. They don't have in mind, or they're not envisioning someone, basically in a permanent coma, 13 years lying in a bed, unable to communicate, think, or feel, and thinking to themselves, would I want to be in that state? Would Jeb Bush? Would the Florida legislature? Would anybody?
Gopal is calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Gopal. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say the Florida legislature or the Governor Jeb Bush has no business in interfering what the court has already decided. The court has decided the case for the last 9 years, and the court, as your previous guest said 2 minutes ago, validated all the claims of the husband. I think it is simply pandering by the Republican legislature and the Republican government, the Republican governor, to the fundamental Christians again.
But what's the interest in pandering? I mean, as Art Kaplan just painted it, many people might feel some fear of being left in this condition for many years. Couldn't you just as easily pander the other way and say, would you like to be in that bed for 13 years?
The husband is the right person to decide all these things. And, oh, my God, if something goes wrong with me, I would like to have my wife to decide what she has to do with me. I certainly don't want to be in a vegetative state for 13 years.
Gopal, we've got it. Art Kaplan, I hear you there.
Yeah, I think there is a bit of pandering in this sense. I think there has been a kind of pro-life rebellion against the ability to take away food and water. The argument is that these are not medical, although in 1990 the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that they are indeed medical treatment, just like dialysis or a ventilator or any other artificial way to keep somebody alive. But there has been resistance, and I think from some of the conservative supporters that the governor and the state legislature are looking toward, they have made a cause, a case out of, if you will, the murder of Terri Schiavo. And I think I agree completely with the caller. We don't want to see third parties, either governors, legislators, other relatives, be allowed to jump in and interfere with intimate family decision-making. Let me just add, too, sorry to be on a soapbox about this. The number of cases where you're going to see other people say, I don't agree with what my husband is doing about dialysis, mm-hmm. or I don't agree that we should donate organs, or I don't agree that we should have an autopsy. If they think they've legislated this just for the single case of Terri Schiavo, I'm going to say legislating for a case of one is impossible. And the governor and the legislature are going to have people parading in there saying, I don't like what my son-in-law is doing. I want to veto it.
Rita Marker, I'll come to you in just a moment. Let me get another call here. Wendy's calling from Boston. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, since the representative from Florida based her decision on what she said was the heinous nature of this death in withdrawing the feeding tube,
mm-hmm.
what other recourses do physicians legally have to let a person pass away?
That's a good question. Rita Marker, how about it? Are there more humane ways than what was prescribed for Terri Schiavo?
Well, you know, if you remove food and fluids from anyone, be they a healthy Olympic athlete or a 39-year-old woman with severe brain damage, they're going to die inevitably of dehydration. It I think, is really so necessary to clarify some erroneous statements that have been made recently.
Well, wait just 1 minute. I want to speak to this caller's question. Is there an alternative that would be more humane?
Well, certainly one can let someone die without subjecting them to all kinds of high-tech things. No one is saying that everybody has to be hooked up to everything but the toaster and the blender.
But withdrawing a feeding tube is not a high-tech solution. It's kind of the lowest-tech solution, isn't it? It's just taking away that support system.
It's taking away food and fluids. It is not something that treats a condition. The placement of the tube is considered medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is taking away the food and fluids, and as I mentioned to you in the previous segment, the court also denied any ability to have her eat by mouth, which was totally inappropriate and I think showed what the intent was. Art mentioned that no other states have done this. In fact, in Michigan and in California, there were cases that were very, very similar. Both the Michigan Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court, when a spouse wanted to end the life of a disabled spouse by removing food and fluids, and when a family member said, no, 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 that was not what they would have wanted, the Michigan Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court both said, in such a case, this should not be the way that a person is forced to die. Terri is not in a permanent coma, although that's what Art said, and that is inappropriate to say that.
He said basically a coma. Is there a distinction that really matters? Well,
I'm asking, what's the
distinction that matters?
I think there's a big difference. A coma is a sleep-like state. Persistent vegetative state is awake but unaware. There are medical experts that have testified that she is in a persistent vegetative state. There are other medical experts that have testified that she is not. Early on, someone mentioned that people have hinted that her husband may have a conflict of interest. In fact, it isn't just hints. These things are in the court record. When Art mentions 19 courts, it is a case...
19 judges, 6 courts, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When he mentions that, I was going to say he was inaccurate as to the number of courts. But it is also a case that it is on the record that there are very real reasons for being concerned about a conflict of interest. Relating to the guardian ad litem, there was a guardian ad litem appointed early on. That guardian ad litem found that, in fact, she was not receiving the rehabilitation that she needed and for which the money had been awarded. That guardian ad litem also found that she did have some possibility of an improvement in condition. Her husband then petitioned the court to remove that guardian ad litem, and Judge Greer, who has been the main judge in all of this, granted that dismissal of the guardian ad litem.
Rita Marker, we've got it. Art Kaplan, I want to get a last word from you. Are we headed into a new era around the right to die with this decision?
I'll say dangerously, yes. I don't agree with Rita that this constitutes some kind of abuse. I think, again, I heard all these allegations. I dismiss them all because that's what every judge who heard them did. I've heard all these claims about her mental state. I dismiss them all because that's what every judge who looked at this did. at the end of the day, I don't wish that Terry Schiavo die. What I wish is that we all be allowed to choose what we want. And that principle, I think, is crucial. I guess we'll enter into an era where others are going to decide if this case goes in the direction that it's going, not you or me.
And with that, we're out of time. Arthur Kaplan at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Rita Marker in Steubenville, Ohio, Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, thank you for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a call to end political name-calling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The headline of a column at townhall.com today blares, "Why Liberal Secularists Want to Kill Terry Schiavo." Democrats at yesterday's Senate nomination hearing assailed federal appellate nominee Janice Rogers Brown for her, quote, right-wing ideology. Indianapolis resident Susan Cease Kennedy is tired of the labeling and name-calling that dominates American political discussions, even at the highest levels. In this radio diary, she questions why Americans are so obsessed with political categories.
I propose a quiz. What highly placed political figure took each of the following actions? Established the Environmental Protection Agency. Pardoned a powerful person who had committed a felony. Changed the rules governing welfare to restrict benefits and add work requirements. Defended the right of gays to serve in the military. Imposed wage and price controls during an inflationary spiral. The answers are Richard Nixon established the EPA and imposed wage and price controls during his presidency. Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon after his resignation. Bill Clinton proposed and signed legislation reforming welfare as we know it, and Barry Goldwater vigorously defended the right of gays to serve openly in the military. If any of these answers comes as a surprise, it's because Americans have increasingly substituted labels for analysis. Turn on talk radio or one of the numerous television shows where political pundits scream at each other, and you'll hear terms like liberal or right-wing used to dismiss a point of view with which the commentator disagrees. What you won't often hear is a reasoned discussion of the merits or flaws of that point of view. In the real world, people rarely take positions that are all liberal or all conservative. Indeed, in the real world, people use those terms without much precision. Is a defense of free speech liberal or conservative? People who believe that government ought not censor speech even when a majority finds that speech offensive are conserving the ideals of the Bill of Rights. Are they then conservative? Recently, the head of the Alabama Christian Coalition, one Roberta Combs, was quoted as saying that, quote, dark and sinister forces have set out to destroy the Christian fabric of our great nation. We will not let liberal judges get away with what they are doing. And what were those liberal judges doing that so enraged Ms. Combs? They were following, conserving, long-settled precedent to the effect that the First and 14th Amendment do not allow government to endorse or sponsor religious beliefs, to choose sides in matters religious. The term political liberal historically referred to those who believed in limiting the power of government over the individual. Political conservatives were those who preferred order and tradition to more expansive personal liberties. A liberal education meant familiarizing oneself with the wide range of human knowledge, history, and literature in hopes of developing a capacity for thoughtful and reasoned decision-making. People who are thoughtful and deliberative are rarely ideologues. Does that make them liberal? People who recognize the value of liberal democratic institutions want to protect those institutions. Are they conservative? What's in a name?
Sheila Cease Kennedy teaches law and public policy at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs. She lives in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.